Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure, Season 4 in American Tragedy. I'm your host, your friend, your ear lover, your literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black, beginning today with a little weather report. It's been just dreary and overcast here in Savannah for the past 3 days. We've had some heavy rains. We've had some popping thunderstorms. We've just run the gamut, and it's gotten chilly. Positively bucolic only days ago, and now the chill has returned along with it the damp, and me in my denim shirt observing the whole meteorological parade as it passes by my setting. Somebody sent me a nice little thing about Theodore Dreiser on Instagram. I guess it was taken from a museum in Indiana acknowledging Theodore Dreiser's contributions to literature. He was an Indianan, and the little plaque made a point of saying, oh, you know, he wrote about all the social ills of the time, et cetera, et cetera. And An American Tragedy was made into a movie called A Place in the Sun, and so on and so forth. But I thought that was interesting. You know, I can't help but pick up little pieces of detritus about our various authors as we go along. As you know, it is my rule not to learn too much, really, or anything about the writers beforehand, because I am inclined to let whatever the work is stand on its own 2 feet if it can. And so far, although we have had at least one wobbly novel, in terms of being able to stand on its own 2 feet, and here I am referring to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, all of the novels have been able to do that, have been able to stand apart from their authors and, you know, just be works of art. And had they been anonymous, we'd be like, yeah, these are works of art. You know what I mean? That's why I don't learn anything about the authors. I don't want my opinion colored. I don't want any of it. But inevitably, as you go along, as you're reading these books, you find out a thing or two. And of course, we already knew about Dreiser being some sort of naturalist. I say some sort of because it's not strict to me. You know, there's a kind of piety to his works that speaks of a deep morality at the center of Dreiser's character. And I'm not saying naturalistic authors don't have a morality, but what I am saying is that, as in the case of Hardy with Jude, it seemed like, I guess he's more of a romantic writer, isn't he? Shelley, Wuthering Heights, all romantic. Hardy, other than Dreiser, is probably the closest we've come to a naturalistic author at the time. And Hardy, I would say, didn't make overt judgments on his own characters. Now, I could be misremembering this entirely. But the reason that I mentioned Dreiser's piety at all is because he definitely brings a slant to the book, does he not? He has already editorialized on Clyde's character and seems to carry with him an opprobrium towards this American life, as it were, at least in the first couple of decades of the 20th century. And I will say to Dreiser, friend, it has only gotten worse since then. We are a nation in free fall. And you, my friend, identified that 100 years ago. Well, maybe not exactly. And there are probably those of you who think, Michael, we're not in free fall. We're fine. But it's more dramatic to say we're in free fall. Might be more apt as well. Anyway, let's pick it up. Why don't we? Last time we met, Clyde and his Uncle Samuel were over there at the Union Club in Chicago, and Clyde was asking his uncle for a job, and his uncle was kind of like, well, the kid's well put together, and he's an industrious sort, and I do owe something to my brother, because we kind of shut him out of the inheritance, because he was such a lazy ne'er-do-well, and gee, maybe I should give this kid a chance up there in Lycurgus. So the last thing we read was that there could be no harm in that, meaning in hiring Clyde. Besides, there was his younger brother to whom perhaps both he and his older brother, Alan, owed some form of obligation, if not exactly restitution. So we pick it up again in book two, chapter 23, An American Tragedy. Well, he said after a moment, that is something I would have to think over a little, meaning, can I have a job? I wouldn't be able to say offhand whether there is or not. We wouldn't be able to pay you as much as you make here to begin with, he warned. Oh, that's all right, exclaimed Clyde, who was far more fascinated by the thought of connecting himself with his uncle than anything else. I wouldn't expect very much until I was able to earn it, of course. Besides, it might be that you find that you didn't like the collar business once you got into it. Or we might find that we didn't like you. Not everyone is suited to it by a long way. Yes, well, we've all heard stories about the collar business and how demanding it is. By gall, I mean, if people think, oh, the shirt industry and the collar industry, man, that's just the easy life. Isn't it? I'd just be walking on Easy Street if I was in the collar business. But friends, you have no idea the kinds of pressures that those of us in the collar game are forced to endure. Why, it practically feels like it's strangling us at times, these pressures. That was a collar pun. I don't know if you picked that up or not, but it was terrific. Alrighty. So we, you know, everyone's not suited to it, not by a long way, you know. It's collars. It's about as tough a game as there is. Well, all you'd have to do then would be to discharge me, assured Clyde. I've always thought I would be, though, ever since I heard of you and your big company. I've always thought I could make it in the collar business. If only somebody would give me a chance. Do you know everybody? Nobody will hire you in the collar business these days if you don't have a PhD in collars. This last remark pleased Samuel Griffiths. Plainly, he and his achievements had stood in the nature of an ideal to this youth. Very well, he said. I won't be able to give any more time to this now, but I'll be here for a day or two more anyhow, and I'll think it over. It may be that I will be able to say something, to do something for you. I can't say now. And he turned quite abruptly to his letters. And Clyde, feeling that he had made as good an impression as could be expected under the circumstances, and that something might come of it, thanked him profusely and beat a hasty retreat. Yes, I'm going to beat a hasty retreat from the great man. And he's right. You know, look, If there's one thing Norman Wayne taught us, and when I reference the name Norman Wayne, I am, of course, talking about the father of David Wayne, who used to buy and sell radio stations, for God's sake. That was his career. He bought and sold entire radio stations. But I remember a little piece of advice he gave, which was know when you've got a yes. You know what I mean? Know when you've already made the sale, and then shut your mouth and beat a hasty retreat, which is exactly what Clyde seems to have done here. He recognizes he has made as good an impression as he could make. He got some words of assurance from his uncle, and he knows nothing more is to be gained by remaining. So he beats, as they say, his hasty retreat. I just like saying beats a hasty retreat. It's a cliche at this point, but there is something sort of fun about it. I think it's the beat rhyming with the retreat, and then you got the fun little filling in the middle of hasty. Hasty's a fun word, you know? So it's almost like an Oreo. You got two delicious wafers with beet and retreat, and then you've got hasty right there in the middle, adding a little sweetness. It's fun. The next day, having thought it over and deciding that Clyde, because of his briskness and intelligence, was likely to prove as useful as another, Samuel Griffiths, after due deliberation as to the situation at home, informed Clyde that in case any small opening in the home factory occurred, he would be glad to notify him. But he would not even go so far as to guarantee him that an opening would immediately be forthcoming. He must wait. Accordingly, Clyde was left to speculate as to how soon, if ever, a place in his uncle's factory would be made for him. So his uncle, I think, is doing the right thing here. He's saying, look, the kid's my nephew. He was brought up under different difficult circumstances from my shithead brother, who has never had a pot to piss in. And yet somehow this kid has made his way to one of the finer establishments in all of Chicago, secured himself a position as a bellhop, has demonstrated industry and briskness, and therefore, why shouldn't I give this kid a shot? Yes, I know the collar business isn't for everybody, but you don't know until you get in there and start working with your hands on those collars. You know, you start fiddling with the pneumatic collar making machine, and you start affixing those collars to shirt necklines. And next thing you know, you've produced a fine product any gentleman would be proud to wear about town. And I don't just mean Lycurgus, but I mean Chicago, Illinois, where they know something about fashion. Why shouldn't Samuel Griffiths give his nephew a chance? In the meanwhile, Samuel Griffiths had returned to Lycurgus, and after a later conference with his son, which we, if you recall, we did hear about that conference, he decided that Clyde might be inducted into the very bottom of the business, at least the basement of the Griffiths plant, where the shrinking of all fabrics used in connection with the manufacture of collars was brought about, and where beginners in this industry who really desired to acquire the technique of it were placed. For it was his idea that Clyde, by degrees, was to be taught the business from top to bottom. Well, really, from bottom to top, wouldn't you say, Samuel? From bottom to top, my good man. And since he must support himself in some form not absolutely incompatible with the standing of the Griffiths family here in Lycurgus, it was decided to pay him the munificent sum of $15 to begin. So, Clyde is cooling his jets out there in Chicago. Sam comes in. He says, Gil, I met your cousin. I think we should give him a shot at the factory. Gil, as we know, not loving this idea, particularly because the cousin, this wayward Clyde Griffiths, of the Asa Griffiths clan is said to look just like him, said to look just like Gil. And Gil, you know, he doesn't enjoy that at all. He doesn't like that. Some kid who looks like me is going to come here and threaten my position at the Griffiths collar making company? No thank you, Papa. No thank you indeed. But he's keeping these thoughts to himself. He's keeping quiet counsel at the moment, perhaps suspecting that to rebuff his father would not cause the sun to shine very brightly on himself. You understand what I'm saying? I struggled for the words, but that's just the way it goes sometimes. All right, let's take ourselves a quick little break and return in a moment here on Obscure.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back on Obscure with Clyde, about to get the good news that a position has opened up for him way out there in Lycurgus. Yes, he'll have to work his way up from the bottom. He may even find himself blistering his own fingers as he shrinks down all that fabric to be made for collars. Is the collar business, is that still a thing? Because I feel like it isn't. I mean, it used to be that the collars themselves would attach and detach from the shirt by way of these little brass sticking pins or something that you'd sort of thread the collar in, and then they'd affix, and then you'd tie your cravat up, and, you know, you'd be a fine-looking young gentleman. But hey, I just feel like nowadays the collar is sewn into the shirt itself. So the whole collar industry, I would imagine, has gone belly up. But maybe not. I don't know. And is it really worth cranking up the research machine to figure it out? I don't think so. For a while, Samuel Griffiths, as well as his son Gilbert, realized that this was small pay, not for an ordinary apprentice, but for Clyde, since he was a relative. Yet so inclined were both toward the practical rather than the charitable in connection with all those who worked for them, that the nearer the beginner in this factory was to the clear mark of necessity and compulsion, the better. I'm not sure I understood that. Okay. In connection with all those who worked for him, right, that the nearer the beginner in this factory was to the clear mark of necessity and compulsion, the better. Oh, meaning like they want to pay him essentially as little as possible so that he does not get too big for his britches, but not so little that it is an embarrassment to themselves that they have paid him so little, seeing as he is a blood relative. Now, there are two points of view on this subject. One is how, I don't know, what's the word, cheap of them to not afford Clyde a more handsome salary, but I kind of agree with them here. It's sort of like, look, you want a job, you're going to come here, and you're going to work hard, and you're not going to make like a ton of money. Like, we're going to start you off on the bottom, and we're going to see how you do. And if you apply yourself, And if you learn the trade, and if you show some aptitude for it, then yes, we will promote you within. We will raise your salary. We will let you rise to the highest. Your talents and ambitions will carry you, but only if you earn it, as John Houseman used to say towards the end of his life. John Houseman, the great actor, British, of course, and he used to do these commercials for J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan earned their money the old-fashioned way. They earned it. And then Houseman would scowl at you and collect his J.P. Morgan check. All right. So they're going to pay him a little bit of money, and they're going to see how he does. Neither could tolerate the socialistic theory relative to capitalistic exploitation. Yes. As both saw it, there had to be higher and higher social orders to which the lower social classes could aspire. One had to have castes. One was foolishly interfering with and disrupting necessary and unavoidable social standards when one tried to unduly favor anyone, even a relative. Okay, so let's just stop for a moment here, because I feel somewhat relieved, I have to say, and also a bit vindicated, because here I am from the jump saying Dreiser is criticizing American capitalism. Like, that is the stick that he's going to beat us with throughout this tale. And then here we have Dreiser himself saying that these Richie Riches could tolerate the socialistic theory relative to capitalistic, and then here's this word, exploitation. So we know. So I was right. So yes, I feel vindicated. And the reason it feels good is because I didn't know, I knew that, socialism was sort of, on the march in the 20s, but I didn't exactly tie it to the literal word capitalism, and then that little dipole there, capitalistic exploitation. My goodness, we've practically got a red writing this book. A dyed-in-the-wool red from Indiana named Theodore Dreiser. Who would have thought? Radical. These radical thoughts. And look, does Dreiser believe there should be a caste system? Of course not. Dreiser's an Indiana boy. He was raised on the ideals of American meritocracy. We earn our way, do we not, Mr. Houseman? We earn it. That's what I'm saying. We're just getting a little editorializing here from Dreiser. And he's doing it sort of tongue-in-cheek. I mean, he has a sense of humor about it, which I like. It was necessary when dealing with the classes and intelligences below one, commercially or financially, to handle them according to the standards to which they were accustomed. And the best of these standards were those which held these lower individuals to a clear realization of how difficult it was to come by money. Well, it wasn't hard for Gilbert. He was just born. He was born into it. And Samuel Griffiths himself was left a large sum, which he did. He and Allen were left, I forget how much it was. Was it $30,000 or something like that to split between them? Which, in the turn of the last century would have been quite a princely sum. So what does he mean when he says that money is hard to come by? Well, it's not. It's not if you come from money, which is, when you talk about capitalistic exploits, that is the real trick of capitalism, isn't it? It's the hoarding of resources to the detriment of the have-nots. So that's where they were. It's hard to come by money. To an understanding of how very necessary it was for all who were engaged in what both considered the only really important constructive work of the world, that of material manufacturer to understand how very essential it was to be drilled, and that sharply and systematically, in all the details and processes which comprise that constructive work, and so to become inured to a narrow and abstemious life in so doing. Abstemious, I feel like, is a word I've never seen before, and clearly it means it's the adjectival form of abstain, I would think. It was good for their characters. It informed and strengthened the minds and spirits of those who were destined to rise, and those who were not should be kept right where they were. I mean, it's got a kind of Ayn Randian feel to it, doesn't it? As he's describing the mentality of these more accomplished Griffiths, that one struggles mightily to make something of oneself. And once one does, one owes it to society to keep them where they are, to keep those who are not destined to rise from even daring to dream of rising. It's a cruel worldview, but I suspect that Samuel and Gil Griffiths would say it's actually the more compassionate worldview, because it prevents those of us who come from little from dreaming. And what is a dream if not a heartbreak waiting to happen? So in keeping them poor, in keeping them beholden to their benefactors, those factory owners engaged in the only activity that really matters, material manufacture. I mean, you know, we should be grateful to them. These job creators, these collar makers, these pillars of society, we should be grateful. And I suspect Dreiser thinks about this pretty much what I think of it, which is, yes, we do owe some gratitude to those who would risk their fortunes to create even larger fortunes, and to for whom industry has provided a livelihood. We should be grateful, because we need industry, we need manufacture, we need all of these things. We need workers, we need people who are content with their lots in life. All of that is true, and yet the lack of self-awareness, the pettiness, the self-interest of the moneyed elite does leave a rather sour taste in the mouth, does it not? It does. I'll answer it for you. It does. Accordingly, about a week after that, the nature of Clyde's work having been finally decided upon, a letter was dispatched to him in Chicago by Samuel Griffiths himself, in which he set forth that if he chose, he might present himself any time now within the next few weeks, but he must give due notice in writing of at least 10 days in advance of his appearance, in order that he might be properly arranged for. And upon his arrival, he was to seek out Mr. Gilbert Griffiths at the office of the mill, who would look after him. And upon receipt of this, Clyde was very much thrilled, and at once wrote to his mother that he had actually secured a place with his uncle and was now going to Lycurgus. Also, that he was going to try to achieve a real success now. Whereupon she wrote him a long letter, and we don't know what the contents of it are, but I think we can be sure they will involve the Lord, urging him to be oh so careful of his conduct and associates. Bad companionship was at the root of nearly all of the errors and failures that befell an ambitious Ute such as he. If he would only avoid evil-minded or foolish and headstrong boys and girls, all would be well. It was so easy for a young man of his looks and character to be led astray by an evil woman. He had seen what had befallen him in Kansas City, but now he was still young, and he was going to work for a man who was very rich, and who could do so much for him if he would. and he was to write her frequently as to the outcome of his efforts here. And so, after having notified his uncle as he had requested, Clyde finally took his departure for Lycurgus. But on his arrival there, since his original notification from his uncle had called for no special hour at which to call at the factory, he did not go at once, but instead sought out the important hotel of Lycurgus, the Lycurgus House. Then, finding himself with ample time on his hands and very curious about the character of this city in which he was to work, and his uncle's position in it, he set forth to look it over, his thought being that once he reported and began work, he might not soon have the time again. He now ambled out into Central Avenue, the very heart of Lycurgus, which in this section was crossed by several busy streets, which together with Central Avenue for a few blocks on either side appeared to constitute the business center, all there was to the life and gaiety of Lycurgus. End of chapter. So obviously we'll leave it there. Interesting, though. Kind of an interesting way to end, I feel like. End the chapter, I mean. We're clearly setting up something to happen there as he's ambling along Central Avenue there in Lycurgus. I have a guess as to what it's going to be. You want to hear my guess? I'm guessing he's going to run into Bella there, and he's not going to know she's his cousin, and she's not going to know he's hers. They'll probably exchange some words, although as soon as he introduces himself, then she'll know, because she knows he's coming. So they'll meet, they'll be strangers, they'll strike up a gay conversation, and the next thing you know, he'll be reporting for work with his cousin on his mind. Look, these are the things that happen. And didn't his mother just warn him about being led astray by evil women? Now, I don't think Bella's evil, but she certainly is a climber, a social climber. Although, unlike Hortense Briggs, who was also a social climber, Bella Griffiths finds herself already at the pinnacle of the social scene. So maybe she has nowhere to climb, but she certainly enjoys the summit, does she not? And as she's looking about, her eye is going to fall on her poor cousin, and she is going to want to turn him into society's best. She's going to want to dress him up in tails, and she's going to want to parade him around the Lake District up there with her new pals, and they are going to get themselves into some trouble. Will it be another murder? I don't know, but I certainly hope so. Murder and suicide, it's all I'm ever looking for when I open up one of these works of classic literature and read them to you out loud and comment on them as I go. And so we will leave it there with murder in the air. Well, really, what's in the air is a chance meeting between young Clyde Griffiths and young Bella Griffiths that will almost certainly occur there on Central Avenue. Or maybe he'll meet what's-her-face, the other one. Myra, is that her name, Myra? Don't know. But we'll find out on another star-crossed episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu. This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. We rely on you, the listeners, for support, so please go to patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack, and you will get early access to ad-free episodes and more content from me. That's patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack. See you next time.